Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 491, another interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 19th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Last week we were talking about a number of things, including the Moon Organization, and you had recently been informed, and I had just heard before going on the air, about the death of Gary Webb. Before we get into the subject of the Moon Organization and its position of great power within the Republican right in the current administration, did you have any thoughts about Gary Webb's passing? I want to reference for listeners a couple of eloquent and substantive articles on Robert's website, consortiumnews.com, about Gary Webb's life and work. Is there anything that you wanted to comment on air about Robert, or anything you wanted to develop further about either of those articles, or any other comment of any kind that you wanted to make about Gary Webb?
Well, I mean, no, I think, you know, it is a tragedy that Webb's career and life was pretty much destroyed because he tried to get out a tough story. I know some people felt that it was not done perfectly, and I suppose there always are quibbles you can have with any story, but the larger point of what he was getting at with the bringing the focus back on the Contra drug trafficking, which had occurred in the 1980s and which the Reagan-Bush administration had protected, was far, far more important than any quibbles over some details in his series. And instead of looking at the larger picture of the Reagan-Bush administration's guilt in putting geopolitics, in this case the war against the Sandinistas, ahead of serious and effective law enforcement of stopping cocaine trafficking where the Contras were involved, it's reached the point that should be the larger issue, not Gary Webb. But the sad thing was that the major news organizations, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, focused on Webb and tearing apart his series and then tearing him apart, and failed to really do their job with the American in regard to the American people and hold the Reagan-Bush administration accountable for these very serious crimes of state that were committed. In which the CIA finally did acknowledge that in the fall of 98, the CIA Inspector General acknowledged that more than 50 Contra units or individuals were implicated in the drug trade, that the U.S. government knew about this as early as 1981, that the Reagan-Bush administration did not take action against them, that it essentially protected them for public relations reasons, and that now, this was allowed to go on. And when people tried to stop it, whether law enforcement people or members of Congress or people in the media, they came under pretty fierce attack. The great tragedy is that the major newspapers really joined in those attacks, and to the degree that they destroyed Gary Webb's career, and even when the CIA admitted there was a lot of truth to the general allegations he was making, the newspapers never really made that clear. They never went back and fixed the record and helped Webb get his career back on track. So it was a pretty awful situation, and that if it contributed to his suicide, that's a very big black mark on American journalism.
Yeah, it is, and I also noted that the initial obituary reports, at least as carried in the San Jose Mercury, made a reference to self-inflicted gunshot wounds, plural. Then that changed, and I don't know if that was a typo or whether it was perhaps an indication of something else, but it just...
Wounds, David. But that doesn't mean, you know, people are jumping to conclusions, and I think it's quite sad. I mean, I've communicated with his family. He rewrote two letters, one to his kids describing why he was taking this step. He made preparations. I know there's a lot of murder conspiracy stuff bubbling around on the internet, but obviously everything has to be checked out and looked at carefully. But it doesn't serve memory well to people to get carried away with conspiracy theories. It just kind of makes a joke of it all, and And I think, while one has to be careful and look and see what the facts are, people should not get ahead of the facts.
Yeah, I know. I just thought I've been inundated with emails about that, and I did note that in passing. My own feeling is that what's significant here is that the man's career was murdered, you know, whether or not there was anything. But so he did, apparently he had, this does appear to have been a step that was considered, and that he just basically had gotten really, really down and decided to end it, in your opinion.
Well, that's the way the family sees it, and some of his friends who did keep much closer tabs on him than I did. I've not really been in touch with him for some time, but he was apparently having money troubles, and he was apparently having to move, because that's why the movers were there.
Mm-hmm.
He told them not to come in, to get 911 instead. You know, so I think the evidence points to suicide. I mean, again, one has to look at the facts and see where they lead, but it's but I think people should not just start making a circus out of this.
Yeah, I know, because I've just had people, you know, saying, almost accusing me of covering up Gary Webb's death because I haven't discussed his murder. Well, first of all, I just heard about it before, just before going on air last week to record our last interview, and, you know, again, I noted the obits, but you know, it would seem to me that anybody of good conscience, I'm editorializing a bit, but that anybody of good conscience who had been through what he'd been through, and he'd also lost a job with the state of California, and with these very dark times, I mean, the second Bush administration doesn't figure to be a very good time for investigative reporting, and you noted in some of your articles for Consortium News that what would really appear to be at stake in connection with the 2004 presidential election is whether reality even matters to the American people.
Well, I think we are facing that problem where much of what we are being fed isn't true, and Americans don't seem to hold the government very accountable for that. The Bush administration sold them on weapons of mass destruction, and so did much of the media. And even when we now know, or should know, that they weren't found, we still see these remarkable polls where significant percentages of Americans are saying that weapons of mass destruction were found, or that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And it's almost that there's almost a resistance, a kind of rejection of fact, a rejection of the whole empirical method of the age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost that it sounds like a number of Americans have sort of crossed over into this idea of that faith and belief trumps information, and obviously for journalists that's not a very pleasant picture, because journalism is based on the concept of empiricism and examining the facts and following where they lead, and not just, you know, believing things out of faith, that it goes against journalism. And so if we reach that stage that a significant part of the population doesn't even care what the facts are, it is a dark time for journalism and for reason. And the age of reason is what gave birth to this country. It was what our founding fathers drew upon when they developed the concepts that essentially looked at the idea of giving more and more power to individuals and rights to individuals, compared to what was in existence in Europe at the time, where there was both the idea of the divine right of kings and the power of the churches and religions, which had led to a number of wars. So in the United States, we opted for a different course. But it really came out of this idea that reason and fact and empiricism would allow the government to function for the better interests of the people. And if we're moving in a direction that rejects that, then yes, we're in a we probably have some very dark times ahead.
Yeah, and so all of which is to say that whatever the circumstances are concerning Gary's death, his career was certainly murdered, and these are times that are going to try, we'll update it, people's souls, particularly those people who do rely on, do have faith in the power of intellect and reason, as opposed to faith-based initiatives. Huh? How's that for a transition, Robert? One of the things we spoke about, and it's sort of, a transition element from the subject of Contra Cocaine, which, of course, Gary Webb was very heroic in covering, to an organization that wields tremendous power in this country and in the Republican right, the Moon Organization. which is something that a lot of people are aware of. They know it's a quote cult unquote, but it really is far, far more than a cult. It's a major power base with tremendous economic power, tremendous political power, and something which really isn't very well known. As sort of a transition element, let's very quickly review the cocaine coup, the Moon Organization's role in that, and how that spawned the Contra cocaine connection that Gary Webb so heroically explored.
Well, I think it even goes back a little farther, going back to the origins of the Moon Organization. I mean, Moon was considered somewhat of an eccentric flake, even among some of the religious groups in South Korea. He had believed that he was the Messiah, and that that Jesus had failed, and his job was to purify the human race. Initially by actually having intercourse with women, and he would the idea was blessing the womb. And this was got him in some trouble in his early days, where he was considered somewhat of a sex abuser, and that was how he was just basically a small cult leader. But he made some very important connections to South Korean intelligence. Some of the people who were forming the KCIA, maybe because of the women being available in Moon's cult, were attracted to it and saw its usefulness. And when South Korea began to develop its post-war relations, which took a while with Japan, since they'd been bitter enemies during that time, part of that was that the introduction of Moon to some powerful people in Japan who ran the Yakuza crime syndicates, particularly Sasakawa and Kodama. And those folks also were involved in anti-communist organizations, and Moon worked with them and formed the World Anti-Communist League, or at least made it into an important international force, along with Chiang Kai-shek and some other Asian leaders. So you always had this sort of organized crime component to this to the Moon organization, at least with their associates. And when Moon moved on in the 70s to start operating in South America, he also hooked up with a number of right-wing elements, neo-Nazis in some ways, who also had gotten involved with both the heroin trade and the early cocaine trade, which was just beginning to develop as a drug of choice in that time frame. So in 1980, when some of these right-wing groups were trying to overthrow the government of Bolivia, they were working with the Argentine intelligence services, and the Moon Organization comes in with the World Anti-Communist League, and they help support and fund this coup in Bolivia, which involved some neo-Nazis, involved even old Nazis. Klaus Barbie was a figure in the coup. He had been working with Bolivian intelligence and joined the military folks in helping to overthrow the government, and it was very bloody, and a number of government officials were executed and tortured. And essentially, Bolivia was turned over to the cocaine industry, and it became the secure source of raw cocaine that was then shipped to a place called Medellin in Colombia. And that was the original source of cocaine for the Medellin cartel, at least significant, very secure supply route for the cocaine. And of course, the Medellin cartel then pioneered this idea of how to make it into a big business and ship it heavily into the United States. So even at that early stage, some of the people who later became involved with the Contras, in particular the Argentine intelligence services, were hooked up here. And some of the Argentine intelligence officials who had helped with the cocaine coup and were involved in the money laundering for the cocaine trade moved on to Honduras and set up operations to help the Contras. This was the early stages of the Contra War in the 80-81 time frame. And some of them later testified that they were involved in this, and that there was a testimony before the Kerry investigation in the latter part of the 1980s where one of the Argentine officers described his role in conducting these operations and to using the money laundered through Miami to both fund the cocaine coup operation in Bolivia and then to help with the Contras. So you had, even in those very, very beginning stages, this corruption. And you also had Moon's role. I mean, Moon had sent one of his top lieutenants, Bohipak, to La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, to meet with the cocaine coup leaders, Pac said he raised a throne for Reverend Moon in the highest city in the Americas, La Paz. And so there was this very close relationship that that continued for the early part of the 1980s between the Moon organization and the cocaine coup government of Bolivia. Moon also during this time was suddenly very flush with money. His organization had always been implicated in money laundering operations, and that had really gotten him into some trouble. He ended up, because of a congressional investigation in the 70s, into the so-called KoreaGate affair, which was an influence buying scheme by the Korean government. One of the Korean government's conduits for that influence buying was the Moon organization, and that information then led, in the early 80s to his indictment and prosecution on a tax evasion charge. But really, the core of it was that money was coming in that was not being properly handled, and the U.S. government in these investigations could not really track its source. This was money was being laundered into the United States and being put to use for political and other purposes. And so that's where we ended up, at least by that point, where Moon is very flush with cash. No one seems to know where it's coming from. He then opens up the Washington Times in 1982, which is an important element in what becomes the conservative news media, which in the early 80s was really just forming. One could trace it back a number of years, but by the late 1970s, there was a concerted effort by the conservative foundations to build up their own news media to counter what they saw as a liberal media, the Washington Post for Watergate and the New York Times for some of the CIA stories that had been done. So the idea was to build up that, and one of the big elements was the Washington Times, which gave the conservatives a daily outlet for their information and a way also to spread money around in Washington. They would pay people for columns and for articles, and so they could put money in the pockets of some political figures. Moon also began setting up a number of political conferences and political groups that further spread money around. And some of the Republicans who saw the Republican Party as kind of his target were alarmed. People like Congressman Leach of Iowa had protested some of this and tried to make an issue out of it. The Rapon Society, which was more of a liberal or moderate group of Republicans, did a report that accused the Moon organization of trying to get control of the Republican Party. And when Leach had this news conference, one of the guys who showed up to sort of disrupt the news conference was a young Republican named Grover Norquist. And the Young Republicans was one of the groups that was being supported by Moon. And Norquist shows up to sort of start yelling and being disruptive at this press conference that Leach was holding. Of course, Norquist has since become a major Republican figure in Washington, one of the top advisor to House Speaker Gingrich during the Republican Revolution of the 90s, and to this day a very influential Republican with the Bush administration.
Interrupting very briefly, Robert, veteran listeners will recall a lot of discussion in the For the Record broadcasts about Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute. It was basically part of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Program, which in past years had brought in Nazi war criminals and collaborators from the Iron Guard and so forth. And in the wake of 2001, or September 11, 2001, it eventually emerged that some of the people associated with Norquist's Islamic Institute were people who had connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, people who had connections to the Bank al-Taqwa, which was founded by a former Third Reich intelligence agent, Youssef Nada, and which was, according to official investigations, the major repository for al-Qaeda money. And yet, you talk about Teflon, it just doesn't seem that this kind of stuff sticks, that outrages beyond anything. Can you imagine if it had been, I'm being extemporaneous here, but can you imagine if Bill Clinton or anybody connected with him had connections like that?
Well, obviously, if you have a megaphone, which is what the conservatives spent a lot of money building, it sure helps. And the Washington Times was a big part of that megaphone.
Yeah.
What we've seen since 82, and Moon put about $100 million a year into this. So these are not small figures. He, on the 10th anniversary of the Washington Times, Moon has estimated that his expenses on the newspaper was a bit, amounted to $1 billion. So this is a huge investment in terms of Washington politics and how Washington was being shaped. And what Moon's organization did, what the Washington Times would do, that was really uncommon. People can criticize journalism, and obviously I have, and we all do. But very rarely, hardly ever, do you see news organizations plant stories designed to undermine a campaign of a political opponent. And Moon would plant, or his paper would plant, false stories about, say, Michael Dukakis having psychiatric care, Bill Clinton being a KGB operative. And they'd put these stories out, and while maybe much of the mainstream press would initially ignore them or think that's kind of weird, they'd be picked up in the larger and larger conservative echo chamber. They'd get repeated on radio shows, and so there was it was a way to put in into the public consciousness questions or doubts, kind of like psychological warfare, or disinformation, the kind of propaganda operations that an intelligence entity would conduct in a target country. That's what the CIA might do, for instance, in Chile or Guatemala.
Let me interrupt briefly, Robert. Two of the early people in the Moon organization that you write about in Secrecy and Privilege were Reiichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama, both of them not only Japanese war criminals, but people who played a prominent role in post-war Japan and the Moon organization. Kodama, in his obituary in 1984, was written up as being arguably the CIA's most important contact in their main man, so to speak, in Japan. And you also, in Secrecy and Privilege, talk about a 1992 documentary about the Moon organization called Moon Rising. And in a program that's archived on Real Audio called From Kennebunkport to Pearl Harbor, Bush, Moon, and the Rising Sun, I feature an interview with Daniel Junis, who was featured on that program, and he voiced the opinion, echoing some earlier research on mine, that actually the Moon organization in many ways was the projection of the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, their primary vehicle for imperial expansion and also for the rise of fascism in Japan, down through the ages, so to speak, and around the world. And Kodama was actually a protege of a very important figure in Japanese clandestine politics named Mitsuru Toyama, the prime mover behind the Japanese Black Ocean and Black Dragon Society. So for veteran listeners, again, you can access that program, and when you hear Robert talking about how these are characteristic of psychological warfare campaigns, indeed the heritage of this organization is at one with the types of institutions that do that. Go ahead, Robert.
Right, but you also have in the case of the Moon organization very suspicious money that was being brought in to quite clearly influence the American political process. No one really knows where Moon's money comes from. I mean, it's not from the carnation sales that people might be more familiar with. Those actually haven't been happening for a long time. Some people say, "Oh, he sells pagodas to widows in Japan." Well, I suppose so, but it's the real money has never been explained, and his involvement with organized crime figures has to raise doubts. But there's no question that he has been involved in money laundering. He and I think that was one of the points that his backers in Japan and South Korea understood, that especially in the United States, we afford religious organizations a great deal of latitude for obvious reasons. We believe in freedom of religion. So if you come in under the rubric of a religious organization, you're not going to get some of the scrutiny that you might if you just came in as a corporation or some other kind of business entity. So that's what they used, and often they would send in church members who would bring in large sums of cash, not declared through customs, and then funneled into the Moon organization, which had literally hundreds of companies. And so the money would be laundered through them. And in Secrecy and Privilege, I cite some new information about people who took part in these operations, who describe them from firsthand knowledge. But there also was a book done by Nansuk Hong, who was better known as Nansuk Moon, who was Moon's daughter-in-law. She had married his oldest son, and had this horrible experience with the son, who was a cocaine addict and quite abusive. And she finally fled the family and wrote a book and gave affidavits in court relating to her experiences. And she has described firsthand also how she, on the instructions of Moon's wife, took part in these money laundering operations where she would hide money as they were coming in, not declare them with customs, and then put them into these organizations, which include funding things like the Washington Times. So there's strong evidence that the Washington Times and its political influence is, at least in part, supported by laundered money, illegally brought in money. And what Moon has been able to achieve with this is also protection. Because of his effective use of attacking mostly Democrats and liberals, he has been afforded by the Reagan-Bush administrations and now the current Bush administration a great deal of leeway and protection. The investigations of Moon that sort of reached into the early 80s pretty much stopped. And I also recount cases where I've obtained documents out of the federal government where American citizens plaintively have been sending letters to the Justice Department saying, why aren't these activities of Moon's organization being investigated? And there are all kinds of excuses that the Reagan-Bush administration would provide. One came from Robert Mueller, who then was a senior justice official, and now, of course, he's the FBI director. And he offered some excuse about because Moon had gotten a green card, and there always were reasons why they felt that Moon could not be investigated. Despite this firsthand evidence of continuing criminal activity. So what Moon gets is protection. And he worked closely with the Contras in the 1980s. He provided protection for them in a public relations sense when questions about their drug trafficking first surfaced in 85 and 86. And when Senator John Kerry investigated, Moon's newspaper led the attacks on those investigations. Essentially trying to get even some of Kerry's investigators investigated themselves, accusing them of obstructing justice because they supposedly got in the way of what the Reagan-Bush administration was trying to do. So there were all these pressures that Moon helped bring against people who were investigating these areas, which were very significant criminal matters. And so we ended up with a situation that some of these investigations could not go forward, or went forward much more tepidly than they would have, because of the political and public relations pressure Moon could bring on them. That, of course, was in league with what the Reagan-Bush administration wanted, too, because they wanted the Contras protected. And that leads into these ongoing cover-ups that went on really into the 90s of trying to prevent people from recognizing that the Contras had gotten themselves deeply involved in the cocaine trade in the United States.
Robert, we will pick this up on the other side of this broadcast. We've been speaking with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. For people considering last-minute holiday gift shopping, that would be something to evaluate. We'll be joining Robert Perry again on the second side of this broadcast. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 491, another interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 19th of 2004. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.